Somewhere across the bifrost, way up high.
Welcome to episode 19 of Across the Bifrost. I'm your host, Sung Soo, and I'll be joined shortly by my co-host, Pat Dunford, and a special guest. Before we dive into that, I do want to mention our sponsors real quickly, Muse on Minis. You can check them out at museonminis.com and museonstore.com, purveyors of high-quality gaming products. And we'll be giving away a Muse on Minis token set to one of our lucky patrons in the first week of April. I also want to mention Jay over at Discount Games Incorporated, always allowing the maximum allowed discount for all Marvel Crisis Protocol items. If your local game store isn't into Marvel or just has a problem finding it, be sure to check out Jay over at Discount Games Inc. .com. I do also want to mention the Patreon, the lifeblood, the spice that keeps Pat and I recording. You can check us out over at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. You get episodes about a week early. You get access to our Discord. You get a couple other benefits. I think the Patreon's really cool. And more importantly, you're supporting the podcast. If you're not in a place financially to support the pod, but you still want to help, any likes and shares on social media would be greatly appreciated. All right. Without any further ado, here's my conversation with Pat and our special guest. On the line now, we have the Doctor Strange of Marvel Crisis Protocol, Pat Dunford. Pat, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Sam. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for asking. Plenty of toilet paper, so I'm not too concerned. And joining us for the first time on Across the Bifrost, longtime wargamer and actual doctor, Dr. Norbert Brunhuber. Doc, how are you?
I'm doing great. Also, have plenty of toilet paper, so feeling very cozy.
Pat, we haven't heard. How much toilet paper do you have?
Following the advice of my girlfriend, I have a sufficient amount. It was running dangerously low, but don't worry, that problem's been taken care of.
I feel like sufficient amount for you and my family might be different. I have three young girls, we are not environmentally friendly when it comes to toilet paper.
Oh dear.
But we're working on it, aspiring to be better.
I've replaced my mattress with just toilet paper rolls.
Wow, that's smart. Are you shoving cash inside of it for safety? No.
Yeah, in the little tubes in between.
Wow, this is great. Hey, look for a picture on this on the Patreon. This sounds amazing. For those who haven't met you, would you mind just taking 30 seconds and giving us your quick backstory, Norbert?
Absolutely. So, old-time wargamer. So, I started back in the day of first edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, which is how I got into the geek culture. Did that for many years. And then I always liked ancient history and came across a gaming club at one point and found out about miniature wargaming, and in particular historical miniature wargaming, which kind of just blew my mind that you could recreate these battles on the tabletop. So I did that for about 10 years and was getting a little tired of it when a friend of mine just introduced me to War Machine that they started playing at the shop. And so they finally convinced me to come down for a demo. And I got a demo of it, and the mechanics and the little stompy robots just kind of blew my mind. And I loved just how final each of the games were. There was a real discrete ending to each of the games, which is different from the historical recreations I've been doing. So got into that. That was 13 years ago, I was thinking about. 2007 is when I started playing it. So it was in the middle of Mark I of War Machine. A couple of years later, became a press ganger, which is kind of like their organized play helpers that they used to have. And so helped to develop the community in New Jersey, where I was living at the time. So played that all through Mark II, Mark III, pretty exclusively. And then in 2012, I moved over from the New York area into London. And so joined the London gaming community and immediately found some friends via the War Machine community. So then I started traveling all around Europe and kind of officiating at a lot of events because I became a privateer press judge, kind of like an official referee sort of thing. And started playing a lot too all around Europe. It was really a lot of fun. It was great. And then another friend, namely Mr. Pat Dunford, convinced me to play a game that I had no interest in playing because superheroes weren't really on my radar. And I kept raving about it and kept making me want to come down. So I did finally come down, gave me the demo, and did such a great job evoking the kind of like movie atmosphere that the game is so good at, plus the really, I could see already, the very clever mechanics of it, very similar to the impression I got from War Machine when I first started it. And it was a much smaller game and had a terrain, but a terrain in a pleasing amount. And so suddenly I was like, huh. And so now I've fallen pretty heavily for it. I haven't given up War Machine entirely, but I've definitely picked up MCP as a pretty heavy part of my hobby pastime.
No, that's great. And real quickly, when you say superheroes weren't really on your radar, are you not a big comic book fan? Like, I know you've probably seen some of the movies, right?
Yeah. So when I was started collecting comic books in college, so university, right? And so I collected tons of them, mostly DC, to be fair. Image had just launched, so I started collecting a lot of Image comics and a fair amount of Marvel, but it was more DC because I felt that they were a little more mature in story matter. And definitely collected comic books for a little while, but never like into a fair amount. I mean, I have boxes of them still stacked up, but not to like crazy geeky levels, right? Then I gave those up after graduate school, stopped collecting them because they were getting too expensive. And I also didn't like how the stories kept getting cut across tons of different titles. So I couldn't really follow the storylines very easily anymore, which was really aggravating. So I stopped that. But then the movie started up again. And so I watched all the movies, of course. I mean, the first Batman film was just such a revelation. It was just like, you know, wow, we're finally... Our time has come in the cinema. So I watched all the films, and so I definitely like those. But I never really felt that as an IP, it was really something that I wanted to play on the tabletop, you know? And that's why when I heard I've been waiting for the big news to come out at Gen Con, and because I knew some of the designers from War Machine days, and I was like, oh, I can't wait to see what they're coming out with. And then it was superheroes. And I was like, superheroes. So I forgot about it. But then Pat, you know, like I said, convinced me to try it. And it was really evocative. Like, it really felt like the way they designed the characters, they were doing stuff like I felt like in the movies, to be fair, more than the comic books, because it's been so long since I've been reading the comic books, that I was like, wow, this is actually kind of fun. And like I said, the depth is there. So it wasn't just rolling dice. And so there was some meat to it on top of it. And so that's why I wasn't really looking for it. But now that I'm playing it, it's pretty cool. You know, would I say, could I play this game with... you know, the same mechanics, but with their own IP and maybe something a little more that maybe speaks to me a little more, I probably would have liked that better, but this is actually quite good.
Interesting. No, that's great to hear. I do agree. It definitely has a great evocative feel, and the mechanics are solid. It would be interesting to reskin it with a different IP. I'd be curious to see what the community in general would think, because we definitely have people from both sides, right? War gamers, kind of like what you just described, Doc, who just really appreciate it for the mechanics, the depth of the game. And then people who are just huge Iron Man fanboys, for example.
Right, right.
So it's an interesting kind of melding of worlds.
Yeah, I have to say, I see a lot of models go flying off our local game shop. And we kept treating people in various methods to try to come down and play with us every week like we do. And they don't. And I have to be to wonder if a lot of them, yeah. But I think they're just buying it because they want the models, you know, because they're collectors.
Yeah, that's one of the crazy things in Colorado, at least. We've sold tons of starters. Between the local game stores that I kind of frequent, we've sold over like 115 starters. But it's crazy. On like the Crisis Play Days, I have a hard time getting 10 people. I'm like, where is everyone?
Yeah.
This is not what I would expect. But like you said, a lot of people just want the models. A lot of people kind of playing very, very, very casually at home, which is a fantastic way to play the game. Not besmirching that at all, but it's interesting to me and very different than like you sold a War Machine starter, then the person shows up and starts grinding, right?
Yep, that's it.
It's a different style of game, right? It appeals to a different audience.
Yeah,
but today with the doc, he kind of talked about it. We're going to be talking about garbage trucks, or maybe, you know, terrain more in general. If you haven't checked it out already, you can hop over to atomicmassgames.com/transmissions. where they do like a semi-regular brief articles to provide tips for the game. In particular, we wanted to start talking about the Battlefield setup transmission, which came out several months ago, but a lot of people have missed it. This kind of roughly goes over a guideline of how many pieces of terrain and what size. There's a little chart, and it'll be included in the notes over on Patreon, patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. Real quickly, I'm going to run through them, and I apologize because this isn't going to translate great in podcast form. Basically, we're breaking terrain down into different size values. If you played the game, you understand this. We have size 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then the number of pieces of terrain kind of vary based on size. For size 5 terrain, they say, you know, you might not need one or maybe one item tops. For size 4, we're talking between 1 to 2 pieces, only a couple garbage trucks, which is very disappointing. Size 3, they think between 3 to 6. Size 2 is also 3 to 6. And size 1 is size 2, excuse me, in size 1 terrain, they recommend 2 to 4 pieces of terrain. So we end up with a pretty reasonable variance there. And I know that was kind of one of your points there, right, Norbert? Even within their guide, the amount of terrain that could be on a table kind of varies, not wildly, but it does vary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it doesn't really give you a good sense of why you would want certain amounts of certain kinds or how many of those kinds. Keeping in mind that the 3x3 map, we know for kind of like where all the scenario points are set up, and they're quite broad in many instances. So my point is that they, except for the maybe the 6 inches on every edge, they use quite a bit of the board. And so therefore, you really need a lot of terrain to cover up the table.
Yeah, you really do. I think part of the reason why there's a lot of variance in the guide is just trying to accommodate people with different collections, right? And also different tastes. They don't want to be too prescriptive. They don't want to say you have to have one garbage truck on every table. You have to have 2 newsstands. You know, that would be going too far. But I do think it's really worthwhile to discuss the pros and cons, like you said, because people, I think, make these choices unwittingly. They just have the terrain they have and they play with it. But it has a big impact on the game and the strength of the characters.
Yeah. Now, and that's what triggered this conversation, Pat. I think people, just to orient people in this conversation, we're looking at it not like how many you should put down and things like that, but really what changes in the game because of your choices in terrain and why you may want to change things up.
No, that's a great point. And I know some of our listeners are tired of our War Machine references, but traveling for War Machine taught me that different metas view terrain very, very, very differently. Mm-hmm. There are some metas where I'd go to where there's always a large line of sight blocking piece of terrain, isn't relevant in Atomic Mass games, in the middle of the table. Other metas don't. Some metas have houses the size of dinner plates, right? Some metas have houses the size of tea saucers. And it was very interesting as a traveling War Machine player getting used to that. And you can definitely see how terrain can kind of shape your meta a little bit. So before we kind of get into characters and how they interact with the board, I do want to talk about like the terrain that Atomic Mass Games has provided. The typical terrain I've seen in local game stores. So for me locally, we have a lot of size 4 plus terrain. A lot of our terrain was kind of built with the kind of Warhammer aesthetic in mind, whether that's Age of Sigmar or 40K. So we're talking bigger, blockier pieces of terrain. And one of the reasons I actually fired up my 3D printers again was to kind of make more scattered terrain, more size 2 and size 3 terrain that's interactable. Is that similar to what you guys are seeing across the pond?
Yes, definitely. Here in London, there's no shortage of tables with 40K terrain. And because of the nature of that game, where you're using larger models or bigger squads of troops, you need bigger terrain to make it relevant and to plot line of sight. And really large terrain doesn't work very well in Marvel. And indeed, it's not recommended to use a lot of it. So I, too, have been trying to get more scatter terrain. And thankfully, the starter box does a really good job of adding a lot of size 1 and 2 terrain straight off the bat.
Yeah, I agree. I think we did a count of it. And if you look at the what you get in the box, the core box, is 9 pieces of terrain. Okay. Sorry. We're looking at the wrong number here. Right.
No, it's so, 9 pieces. You're right, Norbert.
Okay.
Are you counting the trash can?
Well, that's a good
question.
Oh, we
didn't count the trash can. You're right.
So... You get, what is it, one size 3 piece, you get 4 size 2 pieces, you get 4 size 1 pieces, and so then you have that trash can, which you're not sure what to do with. So, but if you count that up, then that becomes, 9 pieces, that's right, 9 pieces, which is on the low side, right? Because I think that same transmission mentioned that you want to have a minimum of 12 pieces. Right. So, you know, they do sell that garbage truck. So the way I was looking at it is if you bought a core box and the garbage truck, What that would give you is one size 4 piece, which is different and therefore better. And you could also probably use, if you make it as an actual garbage truck, you'd left over with the tank, the oil tank, for the alternative way you can build it. And so that alternative tank gets you a size 3 piece, which is the same size as the Daily Bugle type sand. So that's 11 pieces altogether, which, you know, is pretty close to the 12 minimum that you want. But that's a minimum. And it's interesting to think about it. You know, if you start making it more on the 20 piece side, which is what I think they're saying is like more on the high side for the game.
No, absolutely. And a great way to kind of expand on that, because I always support buying garbage trucks, is they have put out the New York City terrain pack. Did either of you pick up the terrain pack?
So I didn't, just because I think I mentioned this on the pod previously, but I got so excited for the game that I rent out and bought a full set of terrain from a third party before any of the official models were available. So I didn't get the pack, but the terrain that I did buy has similar ratios in terms of the amount of size 2 and 3 stuff in there.
I didn't buy the New York City one because when I looked at it, I realized it's exactly the same as the core set, except you get one extra Daily Bugle sized building, just like a cafe instead, but it's exactly the same. So when I realized that, I didn't want to pay for that and instead went on eBay and, won an auction for the core set terrain. So I have 2 core sets of terrain, and I will be getting the garbage truck, which I'll make into a garbage truck and have the tanker left over. And so that way I'm covered for the higher side of the game in terms of terrain as well, because I'll have one. I mean, the only thing I might consider getting after that is another something that is size 4 or 5, or just use something at the shop that's 4 or 5, because I do want to have maybe 2 of that size terrain on the table occasionally.
I know you mentioned in the past that you're collecting a horde of garbage trucks.
I am collecting a fleet of garbage trucks, Pat. But yeah, I did pick up the New York City terrain pack. I want to support my local game store, and I kind of just buy one of everything. I guess I'm a bit of a sheep. I do think, I promise. But I did pick up a terrain pack. So it's interesting, right? We all went about kind of different ways of achieving what we need to kind of have a minimum table, right? We all have the ability, it sounds like, to field a 20-piece terrain table. And I think what we're kind of acknowledging is the games are very different whether you're on a 20-piece terrain table or a 12-piece terrain table. So how do we feel the game changes from the low side terrain count to kind of the higher side terrain?
But before we move on, just I wanted to point out, if 2 people come with their core terrain to a game and put them, both of them put it down, then I think you're at that level that we're just about to go into. So there is hope that even if you should recognize that having 2 core sets actually puts you closer to what we're about to talk about.
No, and that's a great point, Norbert. Excellent, excellent point.
Yeah.
So for me, there's a bunch of stuff that changes when you have more terrain on the table. In terms of the characters, there's a load of rules that care about terrain, right? So the ones that spring to mind immediately, you've got wall crawlers, you've got characters with flight, and you've got characters that can throw terrain. And all of those rules become more valuable the more terrain there is on the board.
The flip side of that would be like long range characters, right? Who benefit from kind of a clearer board, less size 3, less size 4 terrain, where they kind of have longer ranges to kind of alleviate their range 4 and their range 5 attacks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Doc, as you've kind of played the game, where do you think the kind of sweet spot is? What terrain, real rough, obviously, what terrain count do you think is kind of ideal or most enjoyable to be playing?
Okay. I temper this response because I ideally, if you're having like a crisis event of some sort, I think it would be really interesting to have some tables on the lower side and some tables on the higher side. And I have to wonder as our meta, as the overall meta starts to mature, if we start behaving that way, it'd be really interesting for roster design, because then you're actually, you know, putting together a roster that can handle heavy terrain or take advantage of heavy terrain, and others that take advantage of less dense terrain. So I would prefer seeing both in any particular day, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I do think that would be really cool. Definitely terrain changes how the game plays a lot. One thing that I see sometimes is people play a game and then they immediately play a second game and they don't change the terrain at all. And I think that is a big mistake. even if you're using the same pieces, just changing the orientation of where they are on the table can have a huge impact on how a game plays out. You really shouldn't underestimate the role that terrain plays in any given game.
Absolutely. So I feel I'm getting the sense, and TT, it would be good to hear how it's going on by you, but I'm getting the sense that people are playing very light terrain games, mostly because they're just playing with the core box material, or feel that's the way the game's supposed to be played. And so I feel that's a bit of a loss, because I don't think it's giving, and we'll go into why, but I don't think that's giving the game a chance to shine in many different ways. As I said, I think that kind of a terrain table is interesting, presents its own particular challenges, but I think the game can change fundamentally if you go with dense terrain, like up to the 20 level, as opposed to 9. How is it by you, TT? What have you seen on your tables?
Locally, it definitely started off as a lighter terrain game. Right, we were playing games with, like you said, kind of a single starter box worth of terrain, and that's definitely kind of grown and evolved as people have played more, because I think we've all locally kind of come to the same conclusion that, okay, terrain is actually a really integral part of the game. Different characters need it to interact with. It's really important. So we've definitely increased it, and we're definitely closer to the 15 to 20 pieces per game now, for sure. And we've definitely migrated away from using some of those super large 40K buildings, and like I said, we've all kind of collected our own assortments of terrain, whether we've made them or purchased them from third parties or kind of flared out. So at least locally in Colorado, we're doing pretty well about staying to a higher terrain count. And I have an event I'm running actually end of March. And I'll be sure that I actually like what you're saying there, Norbert. I might have some tables that are a little bit lower in terrain, but some are definitely going to be pretty dense.
Yeah. I have an event on Saturday, this coming Saturday in March. And I'm totally going to do that as well, because I'm very curious about the experiment. And the challenge it'll bring for folks. But yeah, so, you know, if you have heavier terrain, some of the advantages we talked about, but let's get into it deeper. And I'd love to, and this is what triggered the thought of me, so I'd love to just tackle it right, the big one in the room, which is the you know, kind of the controversial Hulk character in the game. Controversial insofar as is whether he's any good or not. And it struck me as something that Pat said in a past podcast, which was, you know, if you give him more stuff that only he can use around him, he becomes much more valuable, not only because he can utilize then that size and smaller, so he has more options of using stuff, but that stuff, the bigger stuff, hurts more when you get thrown at you. and only he can do that. And so that is... maybe then this is an instance of where having lots of terrain around suddenly makes his value go up.
Yeah, I do think it does. Because, and I think part of the reason that Hulk doesn't shine very much when people first pick him up is, like you said, when you're newer to the game, you're probably just using the core set as your terrain, and that doesn't have any size 4 pieces that Hulk can throw around. It also doesn't have any size 5 pieces, and he can hide behind size 5 pieces, right? And that can help protect him and stop him from being smashed and taken off the table really quickly, which is a common complaint with Hulk. So I think it helps him both offensively and defensively.
So I we could go on a rabbit hole here. I think the reason Hulk kind of underperforms when people first pick him up is he doesn't play like you would think the Incredible Hulk plays. And his stat card can kind of be misleading in that way, right? You see 20 stamina and you think, oh, I'm just going to march him forward. He's going to be fine. He's an Incredible Hulk. He's never going to die. And the next thing you know, he's off the table and you're kind of confused. But pulling it back to kind of on target here, we're talking about terrain. What I'll say from someone who's played Hulk a ton, what Hulk doesn't like on the table is a ton of size 1 and size 2 terrain. He gets limited value interacting with them, but they really impede where his base can be placed and where he can advance to with that short movement. So while I do agree that more larger pieces of terrain benefit Hulk and Thor, I do think that lots of trash cans or light poles or dumpsters can actually really kind of impede Hulk, especially when you look at different scenario elements where you want Hulk to stand, but he has limited places he can go just due to terrain.
Yeah, that's true. The size of the base is a really important aspect of a character's stats that is rarely talked about, right? We take it for granted. But the more terrain on the table, the more of a liability having a large base is. If there's no terrain, it's pretty much entirely upside because it lets you move further. But if you took it to the other extreme and you had terrain every inch of the table, it would be a nightmare, right? It'd be an absolute disaster to have a large base. So that balance is important. And one thing we didn't mention before when we were talking about terrain, but it's important to consider, is it's not just about the size of the terrain in terms of the stat size, but also the physical size of the terrain matters a lot. Because if you have a large piece of terrain that's very, very, takes up a lot of room on the table and has a high size, then it can block line of sight to a huge amount of stuff. But similarly, if you have pieces that have a small footprint, then larger bases can't stand on them. And it can become not just slightly inhibiting, but it can turn things like cars a big no-go areas for Hulk.
Yeah, I was going to make the same point, that he's finally able to stand up and look around at something if he's got size 4 terrain or size 5.
Yeah, because I haven't actually checked, probably should check this, but can he stand on the Daily Bugle? Is it wide enough?
I have one. I will do it while we speak.
Thank you.
And I happen to have Hulk on the table.
Perfect. You came prepared.
I did. Oh, it looks like it's going to be easy, actually. Oh, yeah, piece of cake. With room to spare.
Nice. Cool. So that piece of terrain is not too much of a liability for him, but you could easily have a size 3 piece that was a little bit thinner, and suddenly it could be very problematic.
No, and we've actually, locally, that's happened. We have a bus. Someone has a really nice board. It's kind of, they've kind of modeled there, and we can talk about like themed boards later. I think they're really cool. Someone has a really cool board, and it's basically themed like you're on a highway and it's a traffic jam. So lots and lots and lots of cars of different sizes and shapes and like road signs and everything like that, jersey barriers. And they have a bus. And the bus, we agreed, was a size 4 piece of terrain due to its footprint, right? It's very long. It's a long bus. It's one of those city buses, you remember, Norbert, that has the middle kind of flexing compartment in the middle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
It's two buses. But it's very narrow. Hulk actually can't fit on top of it, to Pat's point. So we've been playing with a piece of size 4 terrain that size base can't physically stand on, but is huge, right? As far as like, if it runs across the table, it blocks a ton of line of sight for characters. So it's been a really interesting piece to kind of see on the table. And yeah, with the weird obfuscation of terrain and line of sight, you can definitely end up in some interesting scenarios.
Oh my God, you just triggered a thought me. Are you actually getting the bus to move in between turns?
We've tried it. It's a bit too much random. We actually had two traffic patterns and they kind of continue moving. It's getting very narrative. It was a lot of fun, but the competitive tryhard in me is the pain in the butt.
Was it? Okay.
But this person actually has rules for like getting hit by a car and everything. So it's kind of cool. I can post them on the Discord. It was a lot of fun for a short game. It is not something I personally have a desire to do again.
I actually think that sounds really cool.
Yeah, me too.
It was fun, but I don't want to play Frogger every time I'm playing Marvel Crisis Protocol. Well, I think it's basically what this game deteriorated to.
Yeah, maybe it's too much. Like, if it were just the bus that came like hurtling through the board at one point, you know, as in the films, like an out of control bus because of what the characters are doing. Or rather, maybe that's it. It's like somebody's holding the bus back, and then if you roll the wrong thing, you know, every turn you roll to see if the bus gets kind of loose, and then it goes through the board somehow. Anyway,
yeah, I've seen that with like subway and train boards, but yeah, we're down a rabbit hole here for sure. Okay. So I think it's great to kind of talk about Hulk and Thor. Obviously, their ability to throw size 4 pieces of terrain. I believe those are the only two that can throw size 4 pieces of terrain in the game right now. But can we take a minute and like, what heroes really shine when it comes to interacting with terrain? Not only Hulk and Thor, right? But what heroes really benefit from terrain, and then what type of terrain do they benefit from?
I would mention anything that has an attack that doesn't have a line of sight aspect to it, like homing rockets on Iron Man would benefit from a lot of terrain in a sense, because he could hide behind stuff and other people could try to hide, but he can still manage to hit them.
Yeah, those kind of attacks usually also ignore cover, right? So he likes being on a table where lots of people are getting cover easily, and he can take advantage of it, but also ignore it when his opponents have it.
Right. And yeah, all the flight and web crawling abilities suddenly become much more powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can imagine a really dense terrain, like if it, let's say even a pocket on the board that's particularly dense, suddenly these people just, you know, they don't care about it at all.
Yeah, one of the things we discussed in previous episode was how to take advantage of certain crises, doing aggressive turn one plays to take enemy objectives, and terrain can throw a huge spanner in the works for a long move character who you plan to move twice on the first turn and take an objective. Well, if that's on a big terrain piece, then that plan right. goes out the window if they don't have Warcrawler afloat.
So how do we feel about characters that have pushes on them? Like, I'm thinking about Black Panther, who also kind of falls into that move across the board quickly. I'm thinking about Shuri. How do you feel they interact with more terrain? Is it beneficial or is it a hindrance for them?
Oh, it's a massive hindrance. We mentioned that throws are good just because you can throw terrain. And throwing enemy characters is still helpful when there's a lot of terrain around. But it's quite easy to defend yourself from the movement aspect of throws and indeed from pushes when there's a lot of terrain. Because you can park your character with their base touching it and protect from a lot of different angles that you could be pushed away.
Mm-hmm. So when we're building a... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to just say, to my mind, the character that wins the prize, and I'm going to steal your point here, Norbert. So if you want to make it instead, you feel free. Feel free to interrupt. But the character that wins the prize for being best of terrain right now is another doctor, Doc Ock, because he ticks all the boxes, right? He's a war crawler. He's got a throw, and he's got an attack that ignores line of sight and cover. So he gets better and better the more terrain is on the table.
Yeah, and I think he falls into the same categories. Hulk is somewhat doesn't shine very much, and I really think it's because people haven't given him the tools that he's supposed to be able to take advantage of, namely terrain. I think he, because of all those things you mentioned to him, suddenly he becomes this super multifaceted aspects to him that other characters just find a hindrance or not be able to take advantage of.
Jacob from Xavier Christ's Protocol, he's very excited we're talking about Doc Ock right now.
His pet favorite. Another character that people are often down on, but who is great with terrain, of course, is Spider-Man. And when you were saying that about Doc Ock, Norbert, I was thinking exactly the same thing about Spider-Man. He's a character who can really abuse terrain very, very well, but doesn't do so well when there's just a couple of lampposts on the table.
Yep, exactly. And again, also somewhat underwhelming model. And again, I'm really, this is just showing you how much depth is in the game. These characters get unlocked, even just based on the way the table setup is.
Awesome. And I don't want to get too speculatory, but it sounds like a future kind of Spider Alliance affiliation could be kind of right up the alley for terrain heavy boards. Yeah. So we've kind of talked about things we like for terrain heavy boards and characters we kind of want with them. Can we circle back to like, what are characters that are really slowed down or hampered by terrain? I know we talked about how blasters kind of shine when the board's wide open. We talked about Shuri kind of benefiting obviously from wide open boards, but what are characters that are really slowed down and hampered by heavy terrain boards?
Yeah, so we also already mentioned it, but if you have a long movement and you don't have a way to mitigate terrain, it's a big problem. And can really impact how effective those characters are, to the point where personally, when I'm picking my characters for my roster to put in my team at the start of the game, I am sure to look at the terrain, think about where the objectives are going to be, and that might influence whether or not I take a long move character, because sometimes that long move just is not as valuable as you think it's going to be.
Yeah, and in fact, somebody like Crossbones, one of his weaknesses in quotes is his slow speed. But if you're on a dense terrain table, everybody's going slow a lot of times. And so if you're a long movement character, you're paying in points for a long movement ability that you're not using very much. And so maybe having a dense guy like Crossbones, where his point value is put into other aspects of his build, become more important.
Yeah, for sure. There's also some characters who I'm thinking about that I don't know if they get better or worse, but their value changes. So I'm thinking about something like Rocket, where Rocket in some ways doesn't care about terrain, right? And those ways are, he has a range 5 gun, so he'd like clean line of sight, and he always benefits from cover. So he doesn't care if he's standing in cover, right? But on the other hand, he's size 1. And because he's size 1, that means that he can hide behind size 2 terrain and not be seen, but he can still shoot pretty much everyone else who's size 2 or greater. He can still shoot them, right? So he can see and shoot, but they can't retaliate against him. On the other hand, again, he has to climb up that stuff, right? So it slows him down, but it doesn't slow anyone else down. So the existence of the terrain just has a lot of subtle impacts on how a character works that sometimes aren't immediately obvious.
Yes. I'm assuming he's a medium movement?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I wonder if he can stand on a garbage can, though. Could we use the garbage can for that?
I'm going to mod my rocket. I want the garbage can on the rocket base. He's a trash panda.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. See, Europeans wouldn't know that, TT. This is educational.
What do you mean? Do raccoons that exist in Europe?
No raccoons here.
No.
Are you serious?
None at all.
Nope.
Very sad.
For all the invasive indigenous species issues we have in the world, raccoons have not invaded Europe yet?
Yeah, no, they're not here. What they do have, though, is red foxes in the middle of the city, which blows my mind when I first came here.
Red foxes. This isn't a euphemism? You're actually talking about a fox?
No, it's not a euphemism. It's, yeah, actual red fox, like the kind that would get chased around by horse huntsmen, things like that. They are like the raccoons here. They kind of live like the raccoons, but they're different, obviously.
We have a ton of foxes out where I live, but I understand Colorado's a little different than other places.
Yeah, yeah. In the city,
wow, I can't believe you don't have raccoons. I feel so like, well, yeah. I mean, I live in the burbs.
Yeah, it's different. I'm in the middle of the city, like, you know, zone one.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Asbury Park, so it's interesting. We both spent time in New Jersey. Colorado is very different than anything I experienced on the East Coast. So when Colorado says there is a city or there is traffic, it is a very different meaning than what I grew up experiencing. That makes sense. So yes, there are foxes in the city of Colorado, Denver and Boulder, but they're different kinds of cities.
Okay, last point for the educational moment is that we also don't have skunk over here in Europe. No skunks. They don't know what they smell like. Can you believe that?
Pat, have you ever smelled a skunk?
No. Am I missing out?
Yeah. Well, when you come out here for the American convention, we'll just have to try to get you skunked. It's just part of your...
That sounds great.
Do not let them do that to you, Pat. Do not let them do that to you.
It's like a rite of passage, Norbert. It's like
okay. It's a rite of passage that lasts like 10 days.
Well, I'll float this. In a gaming convention, would you notice if the person standing next to you was skunked, or are your olfactory senses already so upset that you wouldn't notice?
That's a good analogy, Pat. To give you an idea, you would still smell the skunk smell. Oh, top of the
even in the middle of a gaming convention.
Yes.
Okay, we've gone off the rails kind of slightly here. I want to kind of pull us back to terrain. So we've kind of talked about heroes that really shine with terrain. We've talked about heroes that kind of have some issues with terrain. So now I'm going to ask, how should you go about setting up terrain in a fair way? So that no side kind of feels cheated about it. When you're sitting down to a board, kind of before we've decided in a game, what guidelines are you gentlemen using to kind of establish the board? Doc, do you want to lead us off on this?
Sure. And I actually discovered something about how the sequence of starting a game works that troubled me a little bit, to be honest. So I, from my War Machine days, I try to make the board interesting. So I do not try to make it symmetrical, but I try to make it fair. So that means that there might be some advantageous parts of it on one side of the table, but I'd like to have some advantageous aspects to the other side of the table that are different, have a different advantage of some type. And as I mentioned before, I really want to try to have a variety of dense and light tables if I'm running a bigger event of some sort. How do you do it, Pat?
Yeah, I already am falling into a habit where I'll be honest, I get all the terrain that I've brought with me for the game, I get it all out, and I put it in the central third of the table. So basically cutting out the deployment zones from either player,
right,
and then just putting a big old line of terrain through the rest. I find that terrain in deployment zones is basically irrelevant. There's pretty much no need to ever be in the area after the first turn, so it's pretty wasted, and I like to have the density of terrain.
Sure. I was just going to ask, though, for the scenarios that are very wide, that have the points in the corners of a box, so to speak, you don't think having a bit, if you scattered some terrain around that point towards the board edges, okay, so away from the center, does that already put them into this deployment zones, like the first 6 inches, or is that still outside the outside the 6 inches? Because, I mean, that would be the only time I was thinking, is if you could have a few bits of terrain on the other side of the points, that might be more stuff to throw and things once you're contesting that point.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's not that terrain and deployment will never matter. It absolutely can. I just think it doesn't come up most of the time. And I don't yet have enough terrain that I can fit into my case and take with me that I ration it, I guess, and I just cut it out of that third. But if I had enough terrain, I would definitely put it everywhere. And that, I think, goes a long way to making the table look better as well and creating a more realistic and cool-looking environment if you can spread it more evenly.
Yeah, I'm with you. If I had a limited amount, obviously, it'd be more important to have it in the middle. But this is my point about trying to get to the 20-piece, if not higher, actually. But make sure, if you do higher than that, maybe put it more on these, like, less used areas so that it looks better, number one, but also may give you some interesting options at a late stage part of the game.
Yeah, that's a great point. I also wanted to add that the rule book has actually got quite a lot of rules that govern how to set up terrain. I don't want to go into all of them. Obviously, we can check that. Any of our listeners can check that at their leisure. But one important point not to be overlooked is it does say quite clearly that both players should agree on the distribution of terrain and how it's placed on the table. It's important, really important, to get consensus on terrain with your opponent. And it shouldn't be something that causes friction. And you shouldn't be trying to get a competitive advantage with your terrain, right? When we talk about characters that are good, we're talking about, or at least I think we're talking about, putting terrain down that's mutually agreeable, whether that's sparse or dense, and then figuring out which characters we want to take with that in mind. Not thinking, oh, my opponent's going to take Hulk, so I'm going to make the table as sparse as possible.
And that brings up an interesting point, Pat, because unlike other competitive games that I've played, here you need to reset the terrain every game because it, you know, once you throw it, it goes away and gets put to the side. And that's really interesting whether we should let the players do that or whether the referee of the event should be doing that.
That is a really good point.
I don't know.
I'm not sure either. I think it's one of those things where my experience for organized play in general with any minis game is over time, terrain slowly but surely gravitates to the edges of the table.
Yes.
As people, you know,
so true.
Kind of try and make space to put down their carry case or fit their drink or put down their widgets or their rulers and whatever, their dice tray or whatever. And I think it's just good practice in general for any event to do quick checks of the terrain between rounds and try to make sure it's still in a good spot.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe let the players do the most of it and then come by and spot check it and make some adjustments as a neutral party. Yeah. The thing that I didn't like, I alluded to earlier about the sequence of events, is that the player chooses the side of the table that they want to play on, whichever player it is, and then the scenario gets set up. Am I getting that right? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, and I find that a little odd because I would want to see where the scenario points are relevant to the terrain before I knew which side of the table I wanted to be on. Because that's my one advantage of not having priority, so it's quite important. And I feel like knowing where stuff is around points will influence which Sable Edge I want and also which characters in my roster I want to take as a result.
Yeah, so if we talk through the step-by-step of how this works, right? You deploy the terrain in a mutually agreeable fashion. Then you determine priority. And after determining priority, one player selects the table side they're going to deploy on. Then you build the mission. Is that correct?
This is what I'm thinking.
No. Okay, so here's how it works. Maybe we can cut this together, Sung, to be a bit smoother. But here's how it works. Okay, so step one, you create your battlefield, mutually agreeable terrain. Check. Step two, you determine priority. Okay, then you set up the mission, which is, you decide who's going to have which set of crisis cards. You determine your secure and your extract. You see which two cards you're playing. And then at that point, the player without the priority chooses their table edge. So technically, you do it before you set up the mission, but after you know what the actual mission is. So for all practical purposes, you know the mission, so you can extrapolate where the objectives are going to be.
Sure.
So I don't know. I think as a shortcut, it's probably sensible, if you're not sure, just to set up the mission first, because you have that knowledge. It just might be hard to visualize without going through the motions of setting it up.
That's my point. I need to see it. Yeah, because, you know, eyeballing it and then seeing how close it is to certain pieces during or not is something that I'm not, you know, I don't feel like I need to guess at. And I also don't see the point, like, why not have that information? You know, like, why make people guess before you choose the table edge?
So the reason is that if you set up the, basically, the reason is quite simple, but it might not be obvious until you think about it. And that's because there are four table edges. But the deployment cards for crises only reference two of them. So you have to know the table edges that people are on in order to set up the crisis accurately.
Yeah, so you're suggesting that you can play the game from east to west instead of north-south like you normally do?
Right. But then, for example, e-deployment map will have... if you say north to south is how players normally face, e-deployment gamma shelters will have a gamma shelter north, a gamma shelter central, a gamma shelter south. If you set that up before pitting board edge, then you could switch to east-west, right? And throw the whole scenario off. You wouldn't even, that scenario wouldn't even work. You wouldn't have a nearest point anymore. So you have to know where the deployment zones are in order to set up the set up the objectives at all. So it makes logical sense that you have to know, but maybe you just agree what they're going, you set them up in an agreeable way, assuming that you're happy to give up the small amount of equity that comes with being able to pick four table edges instead of two.
That's right.
Well, so this brings up an interesting point to kind of what you built on before, Pat. You are kind of already seated that you don't like placing terrain within deployment zones, correct? And and I'm a fan of that as well. So do you assume a north-south playfield when you set up your terrain, or do you have a ring around the board where you're not putting terrain?
I assume a north-south. I have never played with a maniac who plays across the table.
and I think this kind of circles back to the way that Norbert was approaching it. I think we all kind of assume a north-south playmap. So I understand the flexibility they've built in by allowing us to play east-west, and maybe this will be something that will be covered in a future tournament document, if/maybe when one comes out. But like at a large convention, I can't imagine like Norbert and I are sitting in the middle of a row of gamers, and Norbert goes, "I want to play east-west," and we're both like, and I'm like, "Oh, okay, I guess this is what we're gonna do," and we're just like running kind of under the table or around to move models on either side randomly. So it'll be interesting to see if that's something that kind of needs to be in the game.
Hilarious and awful.
So if you're in a gaming, we've all been there. If you're in a strip, if you're in the middle of like a five table thing and you're dead smack in the middle and you need to get to the other side of the table, do you walk around or do you just go under the table? I just go under the table.
It depends, because usually there's a lot of chairs, table legs, people's bags and stuff. I usually walk around.
Yeah. In Europe, most people are like, you know, I'd rather just drink my beer and stay right here. I don't care what table it is.
Seems like a reasonable response.
All right. Well, to try to wrap up kind of the terrain talk, I think we all kind of will encourage people to play on larger terrain boards. And one of the things that Pat kind of mentioned before, if you're in a situation where you can re-rack, if you're not going to change the terrain, what I encourage you to do is either add or remove pieces. For me personally, it's been very interesting. If Pat and I were to sit down and play a game with 15 terrain pieces, we end up with a victor. I don't want to change anything other than add four more terrain pieces and play the same game. And to me, that's been extremely beneficial and telling of kind of what models kind of benefit from terrain and how terrain interacts. So for like a small challenge, I would say if you're in a case where you can re-rack, where you're going to play two games against the same opponent, play one on a terrain light board and then run the exact same thing back in a terrain heavy board and, you know, see whether you end up with confirmation of how you think things will play out and just let us know kind of how things go. You can find Pat, I, or Norbert on Facebook, and then you can find me on Twitter at Sung Su. And Doc, I think you're on Twitter as well, right?
I am on Twitter, indeed. Thank you for mentioning it.
So, you can find us on Twitter, and then, of course, obviously, Patreon and the Discord is really popping. Gentlemen, is there anything else we want to talk about of terrain before we kind of move forward?
No, I'm really looking forward to seeing how people experiment with this. I hope we start a trend in the community as a result. I think it enhances another level of this game, of the depths that we're just only starting to plumb.
Yeah, really adds to the fun.
So, I know we're a little long in time, but I want to take 5 or 10 minutes here. Pat, I don't know if you remember this, but years and years and years ago, we had our first, one of our first podcasts together way back in 2018. I'm sure you remember it. It was a monumentous occasion. And I kind of wrapped up the pod by talking to you about words that are different between the American and English vocabulary. And we have a very interesting person here with us. Because Norbert, you've lived in both places.
Yes.
So we're going to use you to kind of litigate and to make the ultimate deciding factor on a very, very important controversy that has plagued Pat and I since we've met each other.
Oh.
When you walk into a building, what floor are you on?
I do have to second guess myself. Now, it really depends on which building you're standing in. But my inclination is still to think of it as the first floor when it is not. It is the ground floor.
But it is the first floor you've walked into.
Like I said, it depends on where that building is standing.
And the ground could be anywhere depending on how the building is oriented. But the where the main door to the building is, that's the first floor.
You should actually, if you really want to get into the weeds on this, you should ask Pat what they call floors that are below ground level here, or multiple levels below ground level.
Well, what do you mean? Well, Pat, what do you call a floor that is underneath the ground floor?
I don't know. What do we
call them? Know either. This was, I don't know. Norbert what seems to
call
think you have
lower ground, lower ground. These, right, Pat? I mean, at least I've seen that.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Lower ground is definitely a thing. I've never seen lower ground. I think at that point, people revert to numbers, right? Just.
Yeah, they go negative numbers.
Sanity.
Yeah. Wait, you actually have negative numbers in your elevator?
Yeah. It'll say net -3.
Really?
Yes. Yep.
You don't have raccoons and you have a net -3 button in your elevator? What is going on?
But hold on. How do you go below ground level without a minus?
You put B in front of it, indicating basement, and then they just start counting. But they still have positive values. So basement 3 would be like the third level of the basement.
Oh, instead of a negative? Well, I guess that's
correct.
See how valuable I've been on this podcast. I've contributed to the Anglo-American relations here.
Which is important, given Brexit. I wish you all nothing but the best. So there we have it. You walk into the first floor. And so then when you go up a level from the first floor, you are, of course, at which floor, Doc?
That'd be the first floor.
Really? So you have two first floors? Are you waffling now?
No. Here, it'd be the second floor.
No, these are interesting things.
Fourth floor, baby.
I'm excited for when Pat comes to America and he gets lost, not knowing what floor his hotel room is on. So thank you all so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Doctor, thanks so much for coming on the pod. It was great to have you. And spoiler, I think, Norbert, are you still planning on going to Adepticon?
Yes, but I'm holding my fingers very tightly crossed that it doesn't get canceled, because it'd be so disappointing after all the effort and time and money that we've invested in it as a community, that it doesn't go forward. But everything going the right way, I'm hope to be there in 2 weeks' time. And also, I got a spot in the official crisis event that Atomic Mass Games is putting on, which is called the Vibramium Heist. So I hope to bring you back a report on how they set that up and how the tables looked and what the gaming was like.
Yeah, so Norbert will be back with us kind of to do a recap after Adepticon, talk about Vibranium Heist and some other things. We're hoping to run Vibranium Heist and MuseCon at the end of June. You can check that out at MuseOn Con on Facebook or MuseOn Store /MuseOnCon. That's a very confusing URL. But I hope you can find it. And like I said, Norbert will definitely be back for another episode. Patreon, stay tuned for the after the credit scene. Everyone else, thank you so much for listening. And gentlemen, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up. There's a pod that I I've heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere across the Bifrost skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
I didn't cough. That was good.